This tape was recorded live at the 1983 Sunstone Symposium, held in Salt Lake City. The Bible as Social Weapon, featuring Gerald LaRue, Professor Emeritus of Biblical Archaeology, University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Let's go now to the session in progress.
The plenary session, beginning 5 minutes ago, you cannot hear. Sorry? Can you hear now, please? Okay. Perhaps I can start with a comment that Thomas Jefferson made on August the 10th, 1787, to his nephew. He said, "Fix reason firmly in her seat, and call to her tribunal every fact, every opinion. Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfold fear." An ardent advocate of bold reason, Gerald A. LaRue, Emeritus Professor of Biblical History and Archaeology at the School of Religion at the University of Southern California, is going to speak on the subject, the Bible as Social Weapon. Gerald LaRue, in addition to this post, also is Adjunct Professor of Gerontology at USC and Lecturer in Bible at the University of Judaism. He is a native of Canada. As a youth, worked in the copper mines in British Columbia, surveyed in the Yukon, and was a juvenile officer at Edmonton, Alberta. Prior to coming to USC, he taught at the Church Divinity School of the Pacific and the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. He worked for 4 years on the executive staff of the National Council of Churches as Associate Director of the Committee for the Use and Understanding of the Bible. Dr. LaRue is a past president of the Pacific Coast section of the American Academy of Religion and was editor of the Bulletin of the American Academy of Religion from 1964 to 1970. He has been a member of the Society of Biblical Literature, the American Schools of Oriental Research, the American Oriental Society, and the Archaeological Institute of America. He is a former editor of the American Humanist Association publication Free Mind, is on the editorial board of The Churchman, the Humanist magazine, and on the research board of The Skeptical Inquirer. His articles have appeared in a variety of learned publications, including the Journal of Bible and Religion, the Personalist, Free Inquiry, Religious Education, The Humanist, Religious Humanism, and the International Journal of Religious Education. His publications include the articles Petra and Babylon in the Biblical World, the books Old Testament Life and Literature, Babylon and the Bible, Your Future in Archaeology, Ancient Myth and Modern Man, and most recently, Human Sexuality and the Bible. He has received several times awards for excellence in teaching and is listed in the Directory of American Scholars, Contemporary Authors, Community Leaders of America, Personalities of the West and Midwest, Who's Who in the West, Who's Who in Religion, and the Dictionary of International Biography. I probably should stop here. This goes on for several pages, and I'm afraid that be more useful to hear from Dr. LaRue. I did want to mention that I first became acquainted with Dr. LaRue through his article in Free Inquiry on an issue reflecting a symposium on creationism, the Bible, and Darwin. And I first actually met Dr. LaRue at a symposium on religion in American politics held at the National Press Club in Washington during a symposium commemorating the birthday of James Madison this last spring. And in his address before a number of media, television and printed media, Dr. LaRue advocated the still controversial principle of separation of church and state. I also want to mention that Dr. LaRue is not unacquainted with the Mormon faith. From a recent article in The Churchman, he demonstrated familiarity with the books of Moses and Abraham, the Doctrine and Covenants, and some of the writings of Bruce R. McConkie. An advocate of the cheerful, skeptical pluralism mentioned this morning, I present Dr. Gerald LaRue.
Thank you, George. I don't know whether I should really thank you for putting me on display like that, but you did, so thank you. After listening to the program last night on art and hearing Levi Peterson and others talk about the controversy that comes with presenting art to the Latter-day Saints, after listening this morning to a very fascinating presentation here in the Empire Room on the Closet Doubter, I began to realize that the land of the saints had its own controversies, and I called to mind a poem by a very famous Christian preacher of another generation, Phillips Brooks, who was having some difficulties with his congregation, and he wrote this: "To live with the saints in heaven is bliss and glory. To live with the saints on earth is often another story." I can't think of a more appropriate spot. However, on learning about the kind of things that can happen out of controversy in this environment, like things in the newspaper, being called before the state president and so on, I stand before you with a certain fear and trembling and feel I may have to call on hidden resources of energy to carry me through this controversial issue. I recall a story of a gentleman who one dark, foggy night had his car stall and decided to take a shortcut home across the cemetery, and stumbling among the tombstones and grave markings, trying to penetrate the fog, he did what you might expect. He fell into an open grave, and it had been cut deep, and it had been cut well. And he was a big guy, and he leapt up, and he grabbed the sides, but the soft earth crumbled beneath his fingers. He put his feet on either side and tried to go up this way, but he came down. And finally, completely winded, he stood in the corner of the grave and said to himself, "I've got to think my way out of this." And as he was thinking, he heard footsteps, and sure enough, somebody else was taking a shortcut, and sure enough, the other person came tumbling down on the grave at his feet. And the other man was a very small man, wiry, and was obviously terrified. And he began to make little whimpering sounds and trying to climb up the sides and go up the corners and so on. And this larger man watched these antics for a few moments, and then he thought, "Well, I better let him know he's not in here alone." So he reached out his hand and he put it on his shoulder, man's shoulder, and he said, "You can't get out of here, bud." But he did. It's these hidden springs of energy I'm going to rely on to get me out of this situation. The subject is the Bible as a social weapon. And it's a serious subject, because in the hands of the ultra-right religionists, the Bible has been transformed from a religious document with significant meaning and authority for believers into a weapon to be used against the implementation of the First Amendment of the Constitution and against the rights and freedoms of those who do not accept certain beliefs or follow certain lifestyles. The Bible is a powerful weapon. It is powerful because in one way or another it touches the life of every individual in this nation, either directly or indirectly. During every hour of the day, somewhere in the United States, and I might add elsewhere in the world, individuals are reading and studying the Bible. Some seek guidance through the maze of life's problems. Some look for insights into human values, and some search for hints about the shape of things to come. And during these same hours of every day, fundamentalist evangelists exhort listeners through the electronic media to accept some particularistic interpretation of biblical passages as a revelation of divine wishes or divine intent. And at the same time, of course, they plead for financial support for their particular divine mission. Now, even if one ignores the radio and television evangelists and preachers, it is almost impossible to escape the merchandising of religious festivals, including Passover and Easter, Hanukkah and Christmas, religious music, commercial displays throughout all our business districts plead for you to give your money to purchase gifts at these particular times. They recall biblical stories. They call to mind references to biblical events. And in addition, even if you ignore these influences, there's always someone in some part of the community in which you live who belongs to a local parent-teachers organization or a local political group who are associated with religious organizations in which the Bible is a central guidebook. And some of these persons do not hesitate to quote the Bible as the authoritative text to interpret whatever is going on. Indeed, today, no one can ignore the influence of the Bible, for the President of these United States has assumed the role of promoter of the Bible and has ignored the First Amendment in proclaiming 1983 the year of the Bible. Now, despite the popularity of the Bible, most Americans know very little about its contents, and most are ignorant of the results of biblical scholarship. During the past century or so, the Bible has been subjected to literary analysis, to study from the points of view of sociologists, archaeologists, Semiticists, linguists, anthropologists, scientists from almost every discipline. And we now recognize the Bible as the product of the Hebrew, Jewish, Christian communities who lived in ancient Palestine, the ancient Near East, some 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. The views of the writers, as expressed in the Bible, reflect the ideas, the concepts, the beliefs current in their own times, and are limited by the extent of knowledge in those times. Because the Bible was produced over a 1,000-year time span, there are variants in the attitudes, and there are some contradictions and a number of anachronisms. In the Near East, as in our present world, beliefs and ideas were not static. They were in flux. And in the Bible, we can trace some of that flow. We can trace ideas that come in from neighboring nations. We can recognize different kinds of literature, different types of literature, including myth, saga or legend, history, interpretation of history, fable, parable, allegory, sermonic tracts, court documents, priestly instructions, prophetic utterances, hymns used in the temple, and apocalyptic commentaries about the intervention of God in the end of time. Each writing is different in style, in purpose, and in significance. Each must be recognized for the kind of literature it is and evaluated and interpreted accordingly. Each must be recognized as echoing the time frame in which it was produced and reflecting the particular point of view of the writer. Questions must be raised about the situation that called forth a particular writing and the author's position within that situation. And ultimately, one must ask, why was this particular writing selected for inclusion in the corpus of sacred writings, and why were other compositions, some of which are mentioned in the Bible, and some of which are known to us as products of the same time period, why were these others not included? And this kind of study is ongoing. It is extended with each new archaeological discovery, with the translation, the continuing translation of ancient Near Eastern texts, with the continuing linguistic studies into some very difficult passages in the Bible. In other words, the use of the Bible by right-wing fundamentalists tends to be both naive and untutored. Then one may say, well, where is all this information about the Bible, and why has it not been shared with the public? The answer is, it is available to anyone who wants to seek it out. It has not been shared with the public because our clergy, who have been trained in the best universities and seminaries in the country, have failed to live up to their calling as teachers and have failed to convey the best information about the Bible to their congregations. And whether they failed because they were fearful of disturbing their parishioners, keep them happy, keep them calm, or whether they believed that such information made available to the laity would undermine the belief in the authority of the Bible, and perhaps of the faith, and perhaps of their utterances from the pulpit, I can't say. I can only say that they have failed to trust their people. And I'll give you two examples. I was asked to lecture at Laverne College, a series of Bible lectures, and the Methodist minister, local church, came over and said, Jerry, I brought my whole congregation over here to hear you. I said, fine. He said, they need to know this stuff. And I said, why don't you tell them? You went to Pacific School of Religion Seminary. You know this stuff. And he said, I don't dare, because the wealthiest supporters in the church are very conservative, and they might be upset and withdraw their support. That's one man's interpretation. The other example is one that fascinates me. I was talking in a congregational church up near Fairfield, California, and in the talk I gave, I mentioned that the Gospel of John is, in the minds of most scholars, written about the end of the first century. When I came to the door of the church, there standing was one of these lovely little ladies, prim black outfit, nice fluffy blouse, a little hat perched on her head, white hair, and standing there with the hands like this. And she said, you said that the Gospel of John was written at the end of the first century. I could feel beads of sweat starting to come out. And I said, that's what most scholars believe. Then the disciple John couldn't have written it. And I said, most scholars believe it was not written by the disciple John. Well, she said, that makes more sense than anything I've ever heard. I could never understand how anybody who wrote knew Jesus personally could write that way. And she said, how long have you known this? And I said, well, it's been known for as long as you've been around. And she said, why hasn't anybody told me? And I said, I suspect it's because they were afraid to. They didn't trust you. Her next question was, where can I get more information? Now, I'd noticed in the minister's study a battered copy of Goodspeed's Introduction to the New Testament, a magnificent text written half a century ago, but readable. So I said, ask him to borrow it. So she did. About 3 weeks later, I got a postcard that said, I am on the most incredible adventure. Religion is making more sense to me now than it ever has. The clergy have not trusted their congregation. Those who are members of the most liberal congregations with the best trained pastors are not trained or not prepared to meet the extravagant claims of the fundamentalists. They may ignore what is being said by these evangelists who wave the Bible in the air as they talk. They may assume also, at the same time, that because these ultra-conservative speakers are quoting the Bible, what they say must be true because nobody has ever asked them to question anything in the Bible. nor have the materials produced by the most liberal churches for education of youth been informative about biblical criticism and biblical research. For more than 20 years, I taught biblical history and archaeology at the University of Southern California. And year by year, I became more and more aware of the failure of synagogues and churches to inform their people. It was depressing to be confronted by the ignorance of these young people who came from denominations that claimed that the one book for the guidance in life, for behavior, for faith, was the Bible. These young people were not only naive, they were ignorant, and they were not prepared for any kind of question about biblical literature beyond what I would call a grade school approach to Bible. Now today, when these young adults are confronted with the claims and demands by fundamentalists, they simply don't know how to respond. For example, there is now pressure from right-wing religious groups to compel our well-trained science teachers in public school to include in their teachings about the universe and its origins the biblical creation accounts. The fact that the creation account in Genesis 1 over to chapter 2, verse 4a, was recorded some 2,500 years ago, before modern science was developed, seems unimportant. What matters is that the account is in the Bible, and therefore it must be true. The fact that some of the ideas in the Genesis account are out of harmony with the findings of modern science doesn't seem to matter either. They can be reinterpreted, or science can be reinterpreted to produce a dubious harmony. For example, the first days of the Bible creation event are described in terms of the Jewish concept of a day, evening and morning. Even unto this day is it so interpreted. But these days passed before there was a sun or moon or stars. And this is a cosmological impossibility. The biblical account states that trees and green growth came into being before there was a sun. And this idea is in conflict with our understanding of photosynthesis. The biblical account is not only wrong, it is impossible. The biblical creationists are compelled to force science into a biblical mold or to force the Bible into a scientific mold, and neither attempt works. The biblical account of creation is mythology. It is not science. It's described as does other mythology from nations surrounding Palestine at that same time, 2,500 years ago, the acts of a divine being. And mythology is classically defined as the story of the acts of divinities. Nor is the Genesis 1 to over to 2:4a account the only creation myth in the Bible. Immediately following, beginning in the second part of the fourth verse of the second chapter, is another account, another story, an older account, if our analysis is right, older by some 500 years, that provides a different order of creation, a different story about creation. The two ideas are in conflict. Like the ancient Egyptians, who also enjoyed several differing creation accounts, the ancient Hebrews were apparently able to live comfortably with conflicting theories. To interpret either biblical myth as science is to do violence to science. Nevertheless, the creationists who are part of the fundamentalist movement, but who claim to be scientists, are attempting to force legislation to compel our public schools to teach biblical creationism in our public school science courses. This is an effort to subvert the principles of separation of church and state of the First Amendment. And because so many in our liberal churches are biblically uninformed, some are willing to go along with the creationists. They ask naively, "What's wrong with saying God started the whole thing?" That's not the issue, and that's not the question. What is at stake is the teaching of biblical mythology as science. I doubt that any educator would object to teaching biblical creation mythology as one of the efforts of our ancestors to come to grips with their cosmos, or as the way in which ancient Hebrews interpreted the universe in the light of their own time. and reference could be made to our other ancestors in Babylon, in Egypt, in the Mediterranean, and in the ancient Orient. Those who also struggled with the question of origin and came up with their own mythic conclusions. But these speculations are not science. They are part of the history of ideas, and that's something quite different. The schools are a target for a constitutional amendment to authorize prayer in public schools. This amendment was introduced by our president during May 1982. It had been called for earlier by Senator Jesse Helms, the Republican senator from North Carolina. Back in 1979, Senator Helms wrote a preface for a book by an evangelist named Homer Duncan. The book was titled Secular Humanism, the Most Dangerous Religion in America. Senator Helms wrote this: "When the Supreme Court prohibited children from participating in voluntary prayers in public schools, the conclusion is inescapable that the Supreme Court not only violated the right of free exercise of religion for all Americans, it also established a national religion in the United States, the religion of secular humanism." President Reagan's 1982 resolution read this way: "Nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to prohibit individual or group prayer in public schools or other public institutions. No person shall be required by the United States or by any state to participate in prayer." And it's not surprising that to read an article that appeared in the editorial section of the Los Angeles Times, written by the fundamentalist evangelist, the Reverend Pat Robertson, this is February the 6th, 1983, who called for a constitutional amendment, quote, "that would restore our freedom to address Almighty God in our schools and public places," unquote. Now, the lack of logic in Senator Helms' statement is obvious. If prayer is not permitted in the public schools, then the Supreme Court is fostering a religion of secular humanism. That's a non sequitur if there ever was one. This is, of course, complete nonsense. It's not worth further comment. The president and the evangelist Robertson are not being entirely upfront either. They know, you know, I know, that there is nothing to prohibit any individual from indulging or engaging in personal silent prayer anywhere at any time. You can do it now. Ask for a bolt of lightning or something. As an educator, I know that some of my students, in the midst of an exam, pray for divine inspiration when their own resources are in difficulty or fail them. What the president and the evangelist and those associated with the so-called moral majority want is public prayer, which almost forces children to participate or face peer group pressures, and that's another thing we could talk about. What is equally interesting for me is the way in which these religionists ignore the Bible when it's convenient for them to do so. Jesus is reported to have told his followers not to pray in public, but to pray in private. And he even provided them with the words that they were to repeat as they prayed. One wonders then if those who call for prayer in the public schools should get their way, whether the next step would say, "And these are the words that you are supposed to use when you pray," and the Lord's Prayer would be the proper prayer for public school meetings. It's not difficult, is it, to understand the objections of the Jews and other religious minorities to this proposed legislation. What Senator Helms and the moral majority do not seem to understand is that there is no dastardly plot afoot by the 10,000 or so registered members of the humanist organization. What they're complaining about is a humanism that was born in the Renaissance and came out of the Protestant Reformation, and out of the Reformation in Catholicism led by Erasmus. Much of what is set forth in humanist manifestos is not abhorrent to liberal religions or even to conservative religions, and indeed has been echoed in some of their stances. Now, I'm not attempting to gloss over the differences between Renaissance and modern humanism, nor am I attempting to suggest that the liberal churches and the present-day humanists are one in outlook. They're not. Two facets of liberal religion and modern humanism do emerge from the kind of thinking that was present in the Renaissance and Reformation movements. The first is the exaltation of the human, and the second is the analytical or critical approach to biblical studies. In other words, the kind of biblical analysis that I have been talking about was born in the religious community. It has been carried on primarily by members of the religious community, and if you go to your library and you look at the list of titles and who the authors are and who the publishers are, they're often denominational publishing houses, and the men and women who write in these books are members of organized churches, Christian and Jewish. Even as the religious right would like to ignore the provisions of the Constitution for the separation of church and state by introducing their particular religious beliefs into the classroom, they would like also to ignore the Constitution by passing legislation to enable textbooks developed for use in state schools to be provided free of charge to schools run by religious organizations. In their own schools, they can teach biblical creationism as science, they can pray, they can read the Bible in the classroom, they can do what they want. It was for these very freedoms that religious schools were developed, to provide particularistic education. Now these same people demand that taxpayers who do not believe in their kind of a mix of religion and education should pay for the textbooks used within their religious schools. And this, again, would be a violation of the separation of church and state. And what is most interesting is what those who supported such legislation failed to realize is that such action gives the government a measure of control over at least some of the textbooks used in the religious schools. And this, again, would begin an entanglement of church and state. Now, beyond the attempt to legislate religion in public education, these same ultra-right religionists have made and continue to make repeated efforts to legislate morals and sexual behavior between consenting adults. In 1975, despite furious opposition by fundamentalists, the California legislature passed a law legalizing all sexual acts between consenting adults, done presumably in the privacy of their own quarters. A group called the Coalition of Christian Citizens, led by State Senator H.L. Richardson, a Republican from Arcadia, California, opposed the bill. In presenting his opposing views, the senator quoted lengthily from the Bible. And thus, through him, the Bible was introduced as a social weapon aimed at limiting the freedom of those whose sexual preferences were not in accord with biblical teachings and not in accord with Senator Richardson's interpretation of biblical teachings. The prime target, of course, was the homosexual community. Nor did the defeat of this measure mark the end of the pressure. A group linked to the Moral Majority, also called Californians for Biblical Morality, was organized in 1981 to continue the pressure to limit the rights and freedoms of homosexuals. Their textbook, the Bible. The rising divorce rate, the disintegration of the traditional family in American life, is an issue that confronts all of us. The Moral Majority spokesman would have us return to the biblical concept of the family. Now, this idea is completely unreal and ignores what has been going on in our nation during this past century. To insist that women go back to the kitchen, and I understand there may be some in your area around who have ideas similar to this, I'm not. But to insist that women go back to the kitchen, to the roles of house mother, I like that, cook and cleaner for the male and for the children, is to ignore the sociological and industrial changes that contributed to the change in the status and role of women. During World War II, and earlier too, but during World War II, in response to a national crisis, women entered the labor market in force, and they demonstrated what many of them had known all along, that they could perform in work that had been restricted to men as capably as the men did. They enjoyed a freedom that they had been denied, a freedom of association, a freedom to earn their own income, a freedom to explore their potential as a human being on a wider creative front. And when their husbands returned from the wars, dual income increased the potential for living a richer and fuller life. And some women did stop work. But when the children grew to college age, they returned to work to help finance higher education for their offspring, particularly if they sent them to USC, and to fill the void in their lives that occurred when the responsibility for children was removed. With the new status came new concepts about human relationships, new demands for recognition, new awareness that it was not necessary to remain in an unhappy marriage, and at the same time, freedom, their freedom became the freedom for the men. And if you read the Garden of Eden story, you will find that Eve, the primal mother, by eating of the forbidden tree of the knowledge of good and evil, lifted humankind from the level of animals and gave them knowledge that had, up to that moment, according to the mythology, had been restricted to the divinities, to the God, his host of the God, knowledge of good and evil. Your dog doesn't know until you tell him, not on our lawn, on the neighbor's lawn. But you are aware of social responsibility. And as Eve, the woman, lifted all humankind through that gesture, so I would argue in our time, women, in discovering and achieving their own freedom, have been freeing males from fixed and very stiff and stolid roles. However, divorce rates rose and they continue to rise. The moral majority blames the change in marriage patterns and the rise in divorce on their whipping child, the humanist movement. They ignore or they are ignorant of sociological facts and data. They call for women to return to the roles set forth for them in the Bible. But they are cautious in the passages they select to emphasize. They ignore the requirement that women dress modestly without fancy hairdos or jewelry and not in expensive clothes. Go to one of their churches and look around. Nor do they press the subject, the teaching that women should be subject to their husbands. It's very much there in the Bible, not too strongly. Jehovah's Witnesses do, but the others not too much. Nor do they press the argument that women should not be teachers and should not teach men. This would immobilize their church schools. They also ignore the teaching attributed to Jesus that any man who divorces and remarries commits adultery. To insist on the validity of this injunction would decimate their congregations and would also indict the president. I raised this question in a dialogue with Tim LaHaye, who is the co-founder of the Moral Majority, in San Diego a year or two ago, and I asked him about this. And when he got to the microphone, he simply said, "I think God will forgive President Reagan." I didn't have time for another question. I wanted to know, forgive him for what? For getting divorced? For marrying Nancy? All right. The listing of issues in which the Bible is used as a social weapon could be extended to include abortion, academic freedom, control of public libraries, and so on. Instead, I want to conclude with a statement about the use of the Bible as a socio-political weapon. I make a few points. The first point is this. The fundamentalists who use the Bible as a socio-political weapon would have us turn to writings that are between 2,000 and 3,000 years old for guidance in morals, human behavior, human sexuality, the interpretation of science, and our national outlook. They would have us ignore or interpret in terms of the Bible the finest achievements of science, psychology, literary analysis, historical research, and comparative religions. They insist that the only ethical stance for our present society can be found in turning the clock back to the worldview of the Hebrew Christian communities of the time of the Bible. In other words, these Bible fundamentalists are anti-progress, and in this sense, they are anti-American, for they would frustrate the very patterns that have made America a world leader. Second point. In their use of the Bible as a social weapon, these fundamentalists attempt to create a climate of fear. They warn that if America does not conform to their interpretation of biblical morality, then this nation will come under the judgment of God and will be punished or be destroyed. And they seek to find in occurrences in our national life fulfillments and warnings from the Bible, prophecies which they interpret and then reinterpret in the most outlandish and unscholarly ways. Through radio and television preaching, they provoke feelings of paranoia, suggesting that their listeners should examine every dimension of American life for hidden humanist or communist or some other influence, for the evidence of conspiracy. We have experienced in these United States the disastrous results of such paranoia in the McCarthy era. The fundamentalists revived those old fears. They would link Russian communism with American humanism, and they conjure up images of co-conspiracy. It is regrettable that our president, in a recent address to the National Association of Evangelicals, called for the opposition to those who would place America in a position of, quote, moral inferiority, unquote. And in that same address, he resurrected the Cold War concept of better dead than communist or better dead than atheist. Now, such rhetoric cannot help but feed into the propaganda of the ultra-right religionists and provide them with more fuel for the paranoia they are engendering within our society. The third point. These fundamentalists, in their use of the Bible as a social weapon, are involved in an effort that could result in the polarization of America into pro-Bible versus all others in politics, in education, in social welfare, and in human freedom. The issues would not be freedom and justice, and concern for human decency, for human well-being, but the Bible versus any other stance. These Bible moralists seek to engender in our youth an insecurity about the validity of our very wonderful educational system. They are made to feel that what they are being taught could be something less than the truth, could be wrong, and that their teachers are either dishonest or dupes of the humanists or stupid or engaged in an educational plot. They encourage their young followers to put belief in biblical teachings, whether applicable or not, whether accurate or not, above the best insights, the best information, the best data that humans have been able to develop so far about our cosmos, about our world, about our human history, about our national history, and about ourselves. Fifth point. These same devout religionists give verbal support to the idea of a pluralistic society, which has made this country so great and so strong, and which at crucial moments enabled this organization, the Mormon Church, to come into being. At the same time, they label and they denigrate every religious group that disagrees with their particular point of view, including the National Council of Churches, Jewish groups, all non-Christian religious organizations, and they're not too sure about some of the newer American Christian religious organizations, like the Seventh-day Adventists, who were talking downstairs, and the Mormons. Some of their labeling of those who oppose their particular positions is virulent. We touched on that a bit this morning in this room. And deliberately confusing. For example, senators who opposed their particularistic stance on abortion were called murderers in violation of the commandment, thou shalt not kill, shalt not commit homicide. These same people were labeled baby killers by those who would confuse a recently impregnated ovum with a fully developed baby. Interesting merging of terms. And the attack goes to the gut of our society's concern for the well-being of children. And finally, and this disturbs me greatly, they're willing to misinterpret, I was going to say reinterpret, but misinterpret American history and constitutional principles and all that provides for the maximizing of freedom and justice for all men, women, and children. They insist that our founding fathers really did not mean what they said when they wrote into the Constitution the First Amendment. And by using their fundamentalist dogma, they would subvert the intention of men like Madison and Jefferson and defeat the very principles upon which this great nation was founded. I am delighted to have been invited to be part of this Sunstone Conference. I have only recently become more acquainted with some of the writings that have been produced by this organization. I congratulate those who are involved with their courage, for their courage, and for their willingness to take a stand. And I would encourage all of you to hear, interpret as you will what I've said, but to look into biblical criticism, biblical analysis, as you hear the ultra-right attempt to use the Bible as a social weapon to limit the freedoms of those who don't buy their particular theological interpretation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This session is now concluded.